because I'm lisping because I lost a tooth.
Oh my god, what happened?
It's one of my bottom front teeth. It's got a crown on it. And I just had a toffee about 10 minutes ago and it came off with it. And it's not painful or anything. And it must have been the root canal thing must have been done on it before because there's no pain and there's no blood particularly, but it's just left me.
Hang on. There's no blood particularly.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. So it just feels like I'm lisping a bit. Like I can't really talk properly at the minute.
I can't hear it.
Should we all go and fuck up our own teeth just so that it balances out?
I think mine are fucked up already.
It's my one lovely piece, so I don't know. I might be able to get it. I think you just stick them back in, apparently, but we'll see what it costs when I go and see the dentist next week.
You're so northern. We're going to just stick it back in with a bit of bloody modelling glue or something.
I'm thinking chewing gum.
Yeah. Take it out to clean it, replace it, lovely.
Yeah. So you stick them in with a bit of cement, apparently, so I might go to the builder's yard tomorrow and get some proper cement.
I had a filling that came out when I was, I think, 20. I had fillings when I was about 19, and then it came out when I broke it when I was about 20. Like, so it was only in there a year. But then I decided, oh, that means I've got no fillings. So I just left it out, and then I didn't go to the dentist again for ages. And then when I went, they're like, your tooth's fallen apart. You should have fillings. I was like, yeah, I did have one.
Horrible, Jay.
I used to open bottles of beer with my teeth, so that tooth's gone.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
I look like Joe Strummer today, so I can live with that.
Well, not like he looks now.
No, so much like now, no. That's his peak.
Sure.
When he was alive and everything.
I turned down a ticket to see him on his last tour.
Oh, man.
And I was on the guest list just because I knew local music people, and so someone had got me on. And then I was in a bad mood on the day, and I was just like, oh, I'll catch him on the next tour.
Yeah, I think I saw him in 97. That was in the first and only time I'd seen him. That was with the Mescaleras.
Oh, yeah. They were good.
Yeah, that was a good gig. That was a really good gig. But, wish I'd had a chance to see him after that, really.
Neither of you think he's just like a middle-class poser, appropriating working-class culture?
We're just ignoring that. We're just ignoring that.
I don't think it matters so much. I think it's more about where you go than where you come from. Although, I am the first to point fingers at certain people for being posers, but I think he owned it, which is the thing. Like, he always admitted that he was a bit of a dick and that he got things wrong. It wasn't like the Bob Dylan thing of just becoming a whole other person. Although he did do that, but ignore everything I just said. He did do that. I was in a pub in Glasgow recently, and there were some punks there. And like, I quickly realised that out of the group of friends I was with, I was the only one who'd really hung out with punks before. Because there was one guy who was chatting to us and got a leather jacket and he'd got Scud tattooed across his forehead. Mm-hmm. And then, we're just chatting and he's a nice guy. And we said, oh, what's your name? And he says, oh, my name's Scud. And I was just like, well, of course it is. And carried on talking. But one of my friends was like, no, I'm sorry, what did you say your name was? I'm sorry, did you say Scud? Did you say your name was Scud? And I was just, oh, good God, just let it go.
You're like punk liaison officer.
I've got to get out of here quick. Although I can't go outside right now because the world is ending outside.
Same here.
Is it snowing up your way yet?
Too much rain for snow.
Oh.
I'm going to build a boat.
We've had a lovely balmy day up in Yorkshire. There's been no rain or anything yet.
Yet.
After being flooded.
That's a qualifier you have to put on. When you live in the north, that's a qualifier you have to use. It hasn't rained yet. Because it's always around the corner.
Where do you guys think the north starts? Because I try and debate this a little bit.
Just outside of Watford.
I think anywhere kind of above Nottingham really is the north for me, really.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
When you get into kind of, particularly, around there you start to see mining towns, don't you, and ex-mining towns and stuff, that kind of says to me the north, really.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a bit of a lazy kind of way of thinking about it, but yeah, I kind of think once you get above Nottingham, it feels a different place to sort of like when you're down going on the train, sort of through the suburbs of the southeast down into London and steaming.
Nottingham's that weird thing. It's in the Midlands, but like the north of Nottingham feels like it's Yorkshire.
Yeah, once you kind of pass, once you're north of Nottingham, you're in sort of Mansfield, aren't you, and Chesterfield and places like that, and that kind of feels very northern to me.
Nottingham's north of Leicester, isn't it? Leicester's a bit more south than Nottingham, isn't it?
Yeah,
Leicester feels south, I reckon.
Yeah, I think Leicester feels a bit south, and Leicester's about, it's like perpendicular to Birmingham, isn't it? Like, so.
Yeah, I mean, Leicester's...
Peterborough's over that way as well, isn't it?
Leicester's where we used to go to buy the drugs.
That's where my two brothers went to university. That's great to hear.
Oh, yeah, no. They went to Leicester University. They saw drugs.
I've been there to watch the football. That's the only time I've been to Leicester.
Yeah.
There's a smash and grab in and out, quick as you like.
I think maybe Leicester feels southern, though, because it's not, it didn't have the heavy industry there particularly, did it? It was more textiles and stuff. So it doesn't feel as post-industrial as somewhere like, I don't know, I think Derby feels very northern, but somewhere, you know, more like Nottingham, perhaps. It's just, it seems to have adapted to being post-industrial a lot better.
Ooh, I think that's a good point.
I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I think once you're north of Nottingham, that feels like you've got a connection there to the north, haven't you? Well, the north traditionally is in terms of the industry and the work. And the other places that maybe, like I say, Leicester's probably reinvented itself around culture to an extent, hasn't it? I think, and obviously a lot more multicultural than kind of places like Hull, I guess, and maybe Liverpool. I don't know, but it's kind of got that. It's not really got a northern vibe, has it, in a way that other cities have, I guess. Like once you're in that sort of area.
We were in Nottingham in September. I took our kid for his stag do, and it felt like a northern city, to be honest. So I'd say Nottingham's north. So anything below that's the south.
Well, I've always found Nottingham people are 50-50. Like, some people from Nottingham, I'll talk to them and they'll go, yeah, we're in the Midlands. And some of them are like, no, we're in Yorkshire. You're like, no, I hate to break it to you, but you're not.
You're definitely not.
Let me break out a map here. Someone up here once asked me where I come from and I said the Midlands, and then they said, where's that? And I was like, well, the clue's in the name, really.
It is a kind of, I don't know, the Midlands, is it? It is a bit of an elusive sort of...
It doesn't have an identity, does it?
Yeah. It's only got that kind of north or south thing. It is like in the middle.
It's allied to the north.
It's got kind of left behind in the media. People don't really know much about it, other than, you know, they know Aston Villa, and that's about it.
I've very rarely even been into Birmingham. You know, it's somewhere I've just kind of passed through on the train more than anything, really.
Birmingham's great. I could live in Birmingham, if not for the Brummies. But it's quite a nice place. I mean, it's fantastic to drink in Birmingham. And there used to be great comedy clubs. And there was a really, really good punk scene when I was of the right age. But it got very, very cliquey, and I got sick of it. It was like the age when punk was kind of... like, you had to be into metal punk or nothing. And I just couldn't be doing with any of that nonsense.
Yeah, I was always into pop punk. You know, it was kind of like the big thing when I was sort of like early 20s around... not so much Hull, but there was a big scene in Grimsby, which is this kind of like small town where things just kind of develop with their own sort of accord, really. And it was a big thing around there. So we used to go across to Grimsby an awful lot in them days and be sort of part of that little scene as well. But yeah, I think without that type of, you know, without that DIY ethic that I was put in front of me all the time, you know, people putting out their own records and their own gigs and doing their own fanzines, I wouldn't have kind of thought of writing, you know, like a novel, you know, that kind of thing that I can do it, you know, if they can do that, why can't I write a novel sort of thing? I needed that sort of kicking into me, I guess, and that's what it did, really.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that sort of punk ethos sort of came through in terms, just do it. Just, you know, if you want to do it, just do it.
Yeah, stop waiting around and go and do it.
Yeah, you know, rather than just thinking, you know, people from old that write novels, you know, I'm just going to write one. Why not? For better or worse, we'll see what happens.
Turned out pretty good. Is that isolation thing though, like that end of the world as well? Because you're geographically disconnected, you do kind of have carte blanche to do what you want a bit more.
I think so. I think, you know, we don't kind of there's always been those going on in Hull. You know, even before it became like trendy for City of Culture. You know, there's always been kind of like a lot of thriving artistic activity, but there has always been that disconnection from the bigger cities. You know, even from Leeds, really. You know, never mind London. There's always been just been that sense if you want to do something, then you just get on and do it. You know, you don't need sort of other people's approval to do it. So I think, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, in one hand, you're free to get on with things and nobody's going to really bother you in a place like Hull about it. But not you're going to get the acclaim either. You know, you are kind of disconnected from the big cities at the same time.
Yeah.
But I guess for Luke, I don't know, the M6 city, you know, Liverpool's got that kind of... he's already got that reputation, hasn't it? And it's already kind of established as a centre for the arts in all sorts of different ways, really.
I think what happened in the 60s helped with that, though, a lot. Yeah. I don't know if it was known for that before, but I mean the 60s with the Cavern Club and the friggin' Beatles and that helped a lot. But I think the city was thriving before that. It's just that at the turn of the century, we'd screwed our industry to the floor already. Because, like, you know, 1700s, we were great slave traders. And then, you know, we woke up and realised that was a bad idea. And that stopped. But before that, we had all kinds of money coming through that. And I think that built the city up. I mean, I've got a picture of Liverpool in, like, the beginning of the 17th century, and there's, like, three guys and a dog, and that's it. You know, it was not, yeah. There was nothing there.
It was just port, wasn't it?
It was just nothing. And then, like, the with us being, like, you know, a port, you know, that where we could go straight into the north of the country, we were perfectly positioned for when the slave trade started. But when that's finished, thankfully, and we start pretending it didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning of the 1900s, we were kind of just like didn't know what we were doing in that city. I say it like I was there, I wasn't. But like if the 60s hadn't happened, I don't know what the city would look like now, because I don't know how much of the money that goes into the city comes from tourism, but I imagine it's quite a lot. Because, you know, the amount of tourists that we get into the city just to see that culture that was brought up in that time
is
monumental to the city. You know, I don't know what it'd be like other than that. I think you'd have the same type of people. I don't know what it'd be like. It's just interesting. I mean, it is interesting how that art and that 60s culture has had a major effect on the city, I think, anyway. But, again, I wasn't there, so I don't know. I could be wrong.
Glasgow was huge for the slave trade. It's something it's only starting to be admitted to now. Like there's starting to be like art exhibitions about it, and you know, kind of talking about what happened. If you walk along the Clyde, there's amazing, beautiful buildings that look kind of like the buildings you see in, you know, colonial America. Mm. The reason is because they were funded by the same thing, and they're from the same era.
We've got exactly the same in Liverpool as well. I mean, we've got a museum now, a slavery museum. I think they've kind of like caught on to the fact that you know, we did some bad shit there, like, and you know, it's like, yeah, they've kind of, but I think they've also like said, like, well, this is the major effect it had on the city as well. I mean, I wrote in the Facebook about the houses that were around the university, which features in the book, which is, you know, it's not a real university, but it is. I should just change the name, mm-hmm. but it was, you know, talking about the buildings that are around that university, because it was the university I went to, and they're all like that, you know, colonial American style houses, you know, the massive big buildings, and they were all owned by shipping merchants. These millionaires that came in during the 18th century and built up and built up and built up, because they basically built the city from what it had been like 100 years earlier. They built the city to what it is today, really, because the people who worked for them, the people who they brought in to transport the goods, and they wanted them to live in the city. You know, we went from a population of like three guys and a dog to like 800,000 people within like, you know, a century and a half. You know, it was a massive deal. But I think it's a good thing when you have stuff like that, though, because it does remind people that, you know, actually, you know, the city was built on the back of this. We've got to make sure that we don't forget that.
Yeah.
We've kind of gone the other way, because in Hull, we're the home of William Wilberforce, the guy who was kind of a driving force, supposedly, behind the abolition of slavery, mm-hmm. one of the driving forces. So we're celebrating from the other angle, and we have a big festival in September, like a full weekend, the Freedom Festival, and it's sort of to celebrate freedom fighters and people who fought against slavery. You know, and it's kind of, there's a strand of it where there's very serious discussion going on about slavery, you know, modern slavery, the kind of things you get like in Eva's books, you know, back to people like Mandela and Wilberforce's legacy, but also sort of tying it in with new sort of ideas of culture. You know, you've got literally, you know, something for everybody. You know, there's band stages, there's theatre, there's comedy, there's all sorts going on, but there is this kind of serious strand that looks at the city's history and how that ties into slavery as well.
So, I mean, the whole thing with Wilberforce and stuff makes me a tad uncomfortable, because it hasn't gone away. And I think Britain's not having a pop at Hull, obviously, because, you know, I really liked Hull. But Britain patting itself on the back that they eradicated it, and you've got more people now in slavery than you've ever had in any point in history.
Yeah.
And I mean, they've sentenced two guys today from kind of around my way to, and they've got 16 and 18 months. They'll probably serve more like 5 or 6. And that's for being illegal gang masters. You know, they've made maybe 100, 150 grand off exploiting dozens of people. And you're in a situation now politically where the government's saying, we're taking this seriously, we're bringing in a new bill. And you've got two guys walking away with, you know, buckle time in prison, really, for really badly exploiting people and intimidating them and threatening them with murder. And when the courts are saying, look, we want to make an example, that's the example they make, an example that says, do you know what, do this for a couple of years, make all this money, we're not really going to punish you. Sorry, go on, John.
Oh, carry on, you were on a good rant there.
No, I'm saying, I think it's kind of, it's in some really screwed up way, it's just become another thing in this country that people say they stand up to, but on the same at the same time, the judiciary is completely complicit in it, and they're completely happy for it to keep going because, you know, the big employers and the big companies that are their mates essentially want a lot of very cheap labour and they don't care how it gets there.
I think there's a contract that's gone back a long way for us for over here. If we've put slavery in the past, but not only that, we've put it off us. So there are places where it's becoming culturally important to talk about it, but even like the way we sneer at America and we go, oh, you know, America's big problem was slavery and the way they were treating the black people. It's like, well, actually, that was us. We're doing that. We exported that to them. They were just carrying on what we were doing, but we kind of put it off onto someone else.
And we were they essentially when that happened as well.
And we've never faced up to it. And at least America, you know, for all of the reasons that culturally they face up to it. And we're just sat over here smoking cigars and going, oh, look at them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at how it is in the Middle East, and you have so many workers brought in from, like, you know, the Philippines and Nepal and all these places. I mean, look, we're going to have the World Cup in Qatar very, very soon, and it's going to have been built with slave labour. Mm. We've got a literary festival next year in Qatar that a bunch of people that we all know are going to go to, and they're going to essentially take blood money in order to be used to whitewash the reputation of a country that's got some really serious human rights issues. And things like literary festivals and sport, we know how brutal regimes whitewash their international image. And anyone who goes and gets involved is kind of complicit in that, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying that because I wasn't.
Would you turn it down, though, Eva?
I would turn it down, absolutely.
Okay.
I would say, there you go, it's on record now. I think I'd be highly annoyed to be arguing about.
Well, yeah, to be honest, I've seen the names of the guy, and I don't think we're likely to be honest.
See, I'm sure to have opinions. But it's it's really easy to look the other way, and I think that's a lot of what people are doing when, you know, it's getting involved in stuff like that is looking the other way.
I think what the issue at the moment is, though, is the fact that the people who are being exploited are people that are sadly a lot of people in this country don't want to be in the first place. They're quite happy to just bother them and just say, like, well, we don't really care what happens to them because we don't want them here anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's such a sad state of affairs that we've got to in this country where, you know, we're a country built on immigrants. We sneered at America saying that they're not, you know, that they're just, you know, 200, 300 years ago, they just, you know, all of a sudden, like, decided they want to become a country. We did exactly the same thing not too distant past as ourselves, you know. You know, we built our health system on immigration. We built our everything, all these things on immigration, and then we turn around and say, like, well, we only want the right people, you know, and like that. Yeah. Just to me, it just doesn't make any sense to me how you can get from one point to the other. Mm. But the thing is that it's really easy to ignore what has happened in this country. And to be honest, I until I read your book, Eva, I didn't know how bad it was. And then as soon as I read your book, and I wanted to find out more about it. And I met up about it. I was like, "Shit, this is awful." You know what was going on, but it's not going to make it. You know, it's not going to make front page news really, because it's like they're not the people we should be caring about, according to some people. And it's so sad that as a society that apparently prides itself on looking after, you know, like the fellow man, and, you know, being nationalistic and things like that. It's sad that we've got to that point. It really
even
is.
Even like the public debate on immigration has given up the ghost, because the minute we start debating it in terms, because we can economically prove that immigrants are good for the country, but the minute we start trying to do it economically, we've lost the argument. Instead of, like, nobody's in public standing up and just saying, look, what kind of culture do we want to live in? Do we want to feed people who need feeding? Do we want to house people who need housing? If someone is abroad and sees us as a better place to live, that's a good thing. But instead, we just just kind of mealy-mouth comply and just go, oh, well, you know, we can prove that it's good for the economy and blah, 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 blah. No, let's just stand up and say, no, it's a good thing.
But the problem is, talking about it economic-wise is because we have to, because we live in such a capitalistic society that everything becomes down to numbers in the end. Mm-hmm. So in any argument with these types of people, you have to talk in their language, unfortunately.
It
is disgusting that we have to.
Do it with the arts as well. Defend, you know, if the arts are funded by the state, and then we'll always leap to going, oh, well, this thing was funded by the state. It was, this play was put on and it went on to make X amount of money on Broadway, instead of going, well, okay, well, this guy who wants to stand up and fart on stage was given the license to do it by the state because it's art.
Yeah.
You know, and we do it with education. We always defend that in financial terms, instead of just going, yeah, we educated a bunch of people.
Yeah, there is no other argument now, is it? It is just absolutely solely money. I think wasn't the Arts Council funding was cut a couple of years ago, and the argument was, well, look, their argument was, for every million you give us, we make 11 back or whatever. And they were like, well, okay, well, you don't need the money at all if you're working on that kind of profit margin.
That's what it comes down to, isn't it? It comes down to this argument of the economic output from art, doesn't it, effectively? That's how it's measured, isn't it? Wrongly, but that's how it's measured.
So, but you probably know quite a bit more about this, Nick, though, because you've been a bit more involved in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and with City of Culture coming up, there is this kind of, I've been kind of invited along to various meetings where nothing's particularly happening yet, but we've been told very clearly that making good art for the sake of good art is not good enough. Mm. It has to be something that has some kind of tangible outcome in terms of either generating money through tourism, I suppose, or in terms of wider engagement with the community in the city, and tangible outcomes, you know. And how do you
predict that? Surely you can't, can you?
That's what I'm going to learn over the next couple of years, I suspect. But the language is very much in terms of, you know, what do we get at the end of this? If we give you X amount of money to put on, say, like a crime festival, what's the outcome from that? And, you know, not just the fact that, you know, we're bringing great writers to the city to talk about their work, you know, and explore the world in different ways. It's about, you know, more tangible outcomes.
Mm-hmm. It'll be a total boost for the local pubs, if nothing else. I mean, you say that with quite a fair degree of certainty.
But it's also because you can't predict what's going to influence people. Like, if we each told stories about, you know, which artists inspired us to write or whatever, we're going to tell different stories, and some of them are going to be really random. You know, like maybe you watched a thing on BBC Two at 1 o'clock in the morning one morning that just switched your brain on, or someone saw something in a pub one day that got them going, or maybe Nick's talking about going to Grimsby, you know, and kind of getting involved in like the punk scene. And that's, you can't do that economically, and you can't predict that. You can't say, oh, well, we've got to bring X amount of people to X place, and they've got to kind of toe this line, because it doesn't work. We don't create artists doing that. I'm talking as if I'm an artist.
No, I think pondering.
You come along to some of these meetings and try and set them straight so we can actually go out and do something useful.
I've learned this year that me speaking in public just leads to failure. Tying yourself to masts politically or publicly, it just ends in defeat and abuse and protection from the police. So, you know.
Do you feel a pressure, though, to not speak about the politics around your book? Because I'm never sure how far it is safe, I'm making bunny ears, safe to go talking about politics. Do you feel like you can be very open about it?
When Old Gold came out, I was very guarded. And then when Runaway Town came out, even though it was about something that I really cared about, I was very, I backed off, and I wouldn't, tried not to give interviews about the sexual politics of it.
Yeah.
But since then, it's just no, fuck it, I'm going to talk about it. And then if it puts people off, then I don't care. I really don't care.
Because you can't care what people like that think. Hmm. I mean, the people that disagree with you, fuck them. I mean, really. But I think, do you think there's maybe a bit of a fear of, I know with mine, because I think it could have gone, I think right-wingers could have looked at it and thought, yeah, she's anti-immigration, and left-wingers could have looked at it and gone, yeah, well, of course she's pro-immigration. But you can't control how they interact with it. And from an economic point of view, it's kind of tempting to go, well, I'll just keep my mouth shut and let everyone see what they want in it. But then that little angry, shouty Question Time viewer in you is just dying to get into an argument about it.
Yeah,
it's really tough.
Plus, I mean, I think art is political. I put this on, I got it on Facebook, Twitter, whatever, one of those things, that we're in an age now where we've all kind of grown up with the idea that art shouldn't be political, but that we accept that art is commerce. You know, I don't know why we've accepted that, but all art is political. It might be like political with a small p. It might be something you want in the subtext. But, you know, you've got something to say, so just say it.
I'm more worried now than when I actually started, you know, talking about my new one, of like, of how it does come across. Because it was, the first thing I did when I talked about it was this library event. And I don't know how much you know about the book, Jay, but it's about, you know, a group of people who are in the older generation than me, and they're like 40s or 50s, who decide that they're going to take back their streets and inverted commas, and they're picking up, you know, news off the streets and reforming them in some, you know, in a violent kind of way. Mm-hmm. When I was talking about the first time I talked about it, I was, you know, I introduced it the way I've introduced it like 14 times since, about the fact that it came from a conversation with my dad over like the last 30 years, where he said, like, oh, you know, all we need to do is get in a van, pick all these scallies up off the street corners and beat them up and put them back and they'll soon stop. And it was over the years I decided, well, I don't really agree with that. But I was talking about that in this library, and the amount of people who were nodding along as I was saying it was like a bit worrying. And as it's gone on, I did an event a couple of weeks ago, and there was this guy who just wanted to just argue the point with me over and over, and it was like talking to a character in a book. And it does worry me, like start to like even put my own thoughts into that arena, where it's like, well, actually, this is where I came from it, because in the book I'm trying to be, you know, in the middle of, you know, I'm showing both sides to the argument, but I know where I stand on the subject. But it's like when I'm talking about it, it's that idea that, like, well, I don't really want to put my own feelings out there, because then they, you know, they judge the book differently when it comes to be read. And it's like, well, you know, it's difficult to judge how much of your own spin on things you should give.
I think readers are going to bring their own baggage to it, whatever
you do. I do, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I agree with that, because there's people who, I mean, like, one of the first people to read it was, I based the main guy in this group who were taking these kids off the streets on like this guy that I know, and my dad, but just, you know, turned it up a few levels, obviously, and made him a lot more violent than they are in real life. But he read the book and was one of the first people to talk to me about it when it came out, and he completely missed a message, you know, and took away something that I didn't think was there. It didn't change his mind whatsoever, but I mean, that's, you know, confirmation bias, isn't it? It's, you know, I'm not going to change something that he's thought for a long time. I'm not going to change his views on that with one book, but hopefully when he's not talking to me, he does actually think about it. But I mean, from the reviews, you can just read the reviews and you can see that people have taken different things from it, you know, and that's, you know, but it's throwing the question out there and just seeing what happens. I think that's what our jobs are, to be honest, more than anything.
Yeah. There's a review I've got here from Runaway Town that's on Amazon. People can read this review if they want. And it's just that, like, the first line of the review says, criminal gangs good, police and local councils bad. And all it is the reviewer has made a decision on what my political position is based on the book, and then spends the review attacking me for it. And, like, the review ends with the word yuck, because they've decided that's what my view is. But, you know, you spend the book asking questions.
But how many really stars did it get?
Answers people take from that.
How many stars did it get, though?
3.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, there are better reviews on Amazon that I've got less stars for.
People don't seem to like being challenged by crime fiction too much. I think that's the thing. Yeah. But, I mean, I think, Luke, with yours, the first time I read you, I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was morally ambiguous, and I thought you did a really fantastic job of humanising the boys that are kidnapped, essentially, when lesser writers would have made them like one-dimensional scallies. I kind of assumed everyone else that read it would see the point you were making, that these are kids that are kind of brutalised by their upbringing and kind of behave in a certain way because of the circumstances they've had. But I'm not, in a way, because of what I've been through in mine, I'm not massively surprised that you run into people who kind of see it potentially as an instruction manual.
I think it's just because it plays into their own thinking more than I mean, it's just, I don't know, it just feels like, and I said this when me and Steve were talking at my launch event, and I said I do feel like the language is getting more and more violent as it goes on, and that generation clash is just getting worse and worse. But that could just be me doing exactly what they're doing and thinking, well, it wasn't like that in my day. You know, it could just be me thinking, like, you know, oh, it's getting worse, when it's not actually getting any worse. It's always been this way. But I'm not sure. I don't know. It is difficult because, I don't want to put that kind of thinking out there, because, my whole thinking with that book was to put another side out there and try and humanise, you know, young people who were disenfranchised from main society. Because a million or so in under 21s who are not in school and not in education, not in training and not in jobs. And that's a huge chunk of people who are not doing it. And it's like, well, you know, to other them is not the answer. You know, to criminalise them and put them in that system is not the answer. Yeah. And it's so I did want to, you know, because I can't even remember what the book was, but I did read something. I did read a book around the time when I was thinking about what I was going to write about in Dying Place. And there was that type of thinking there where they were just dehumanised completely. And it was, you know, when I was writing, it was like, you know, I was very careful to make sure that I didn't do that. But I also had to humanise the bad guys as well. The fact they were bad guys in that situation, because, you know, I don't want to ignore the fact that, you know, young people do cause issues in society, and that's. But it's, you know, the answer isn't to bring violence into their lives or to criminalise them. It's to give them the same opportunities that we may have had at that age, or, you know, our parents may have had at that age.
Those are the moments, I think, when my family start to come into my books, because I don't put them in it as much as they think I do. But say if I'm trying to write a racist character, and you still want to make it a good character, that's when I'll start to think, well, which members of my family are racist? And, you know, because you have honest relationships with those people, you care about them, they're family members, and you just try and think, okay, so I humanize that family member. What is it about them that I find human that I can put on this character? I wrote one character who was an out and out racist in one of my books, and I named him after a family member, and it wasn't until right before the final edit that went to like the publisher when I thought, oh shit, I better change that.
That's what, it's that fear, isn't it? It's the fear of the unknown, isn't it? I guess is how you found that human angle in people there, isn't it, in them situations. They're scared of things that they can't understand, are they, effectively?
Yeah.
I suspect.
That's why I wrote so badly about Albion fans, to be honest. I just don't understand them.
That's a great thing when you've got two sporting teams, isn't it? You can pick on the kind of the other side. I mean, some of the characters in my books are named, the bad guys are named after Hull FC rugby league players because I support the other side of the sea, sir. But so that gets me a bit of stick locally, but people don't generally realise that. But you can add a bit of local colour there, can't you? And I think you can start to explain the place as well, can't you, through sport in that way as well. I found that quite an interesting thing, you know, that kind of, particularly in Hull, where we've got a river down the middle of the city, and it used to be a very much a split between east and west. On the east side of the river, you had the dockers. On the west side, you had the actual trawlermen who went out to sort of like the North Sea fishing for 3 weeks at a time. And they would support very specific sports teams. And then when the slums were cleared out in the 60s, these people were dispersed around the city all over the place into council estates. And them kind of traditional dividing lines started to sort of disappear. I find it was an interesting way of talking about the city rather, and I just thought I was really taking the piss out of people for the sports teams, really.
Mm-hmm. But even that, like, if I do that in Glasgow, I can still get killed.
Researching
Glasgow led me to reading a lot about Liverpool, actually, because I was reading a report that said that up until like the 50s or something, that Liverpool was actually a more sectarian city than Glasgow.
Yeah.
And that the Labour party couldn't get a stronghold because the sectarian issues were too strong. But then at some point, Liverpool got over their shit.
I don't even know when the change happened, but it was very, you know, Catholic Protestant. But I think that was because we've got such a large Irish contingency that came over in the 1800s. I think that's something that they came across from from that section. I don't know. I could be completely wrong, but I think that came over because I don't remember reading anything about it before then. But it was, I think it was bad in the mid 1900s. I remember, my nanny was telling me, this is me Scouse now, rather than me Italian now. She had issues about the fact that she was going out with the Protestants and her parents didn't like that at all. And I think she might have been Catholic in the end, but it was still an issue like 60s, possibly, but it's definitely not there now.
Yeah, no,
I mean, it's such
I blame the Irish.
If anyone can take anything away from this, it's that I blame the Irish. No, I'm joking. But no, but the Irish brought over so much more anyway. So there's, so much good.
Glasgow and Birmingham were the three areas of the UK that got the biggest kind of influx from the Irish diaspora. A word I can never pronounce. I probably got it wrong. But like Liverpool and Birmingham dealt with it better, and Glasgow just can't seem to reconcile itself with its history.
It is strange that like. That I couldn't believe that, because I was reading something about it last year, but I think it was linked to, I think, when Neil Lennon was the Celtic manager, and I was reading something, I could not believe that it was still as strong as it was.
Oh yeah, he was getting bombs in the post.
Yeah, I couldn't get it. It just didn't make no sense to me, because it was like, hang on a minute, it's like 2012, 2013 at this point. I was like, how have we not got
I live in Brighton. I live across the road from the biggest Orange Lodge in the UK. And every Saturday morning they practice, and then they want to go on 12 marches a year, the Orange Order, marching through the city to sing songs about killing Catholics. And we just go, it's fair enough. It's, we've got to give them the right to self-expression. And nobody ever stands up and says, now hang on, I think this is probably wrong. We should maybe stop them doing this.
Now imagine that. Imagine the reaction in certain newspapers if every Saturday we had... a lot of Muslim people doing exactly the same, saying he wanted to kill Catholic people. Apart from the fact that it would never happen, but it would be something that would be every day would be in a certain newspaper, wouldn't it? Because it just would be like, look at these people, look what they're doing. Again, it's because we've othered them. We haven't othered Catholics or Protestants because we've had them in this country for more than 100 years. So we allow them to do these types of things and just go, well, that's just the way they are, and we'll just let them do it. But I tell you now, if it was someone like a Muslim population or some other kind of religion that has come into this country recently, then it would be on the front page of every paper for weeks and weeks and weeks until it stopped. And that's the othering that we do. And it's sad that we can just go, well, it's okay for them. Because I don't think that should happen. And I know as much as a get behind freedom of speech and all that type of thing, I think we can also say that there are certain things that like we don't want to happen in society. And walking around the streets saying that we want to kill Catholics is probably not one of them.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I'm married to a Catholic, so I'm biased.
See, I'm atheist, so it's like,
Me too,
Personally, I'd be like, well, if you want to kill them, kill them. Because the less of that are of them, the better, never joke. But it's, I don't get any of it. I don't understand any kind of hatred towards other religions. Because you're all believing in the same. I'm not going to say that. What I was going to say, but what I mean. It's like
hatred is hardwired into religion. I think that's part of the problem. Religion does other people. That's what it does.
Yeah.
But then that takes us off onto a religious rant. So, can we all just agree then that what we need to do is that the next step needs to be to get the Daily Mail to accept Muslims and focus all of their hatred onto Scientology?
Yeah, that'd be a stance.
Are you sure you want to tangle with them?
I was talking to a Scientologist at BoucherCon. I actually can't remember who it was now. But there was someone there who was a Scientologist, and it just slipped in casually partway through the conversation that they were a Scientologist.
Sir.
Yeah. And I was, actually, I think I do remember now, but I shouldn't say it, wouldn't be fair.
No.
But
you can just message us all
way through the conversation.
I think I know who you are.
It just slipped in. And then they started to walk away, and I was like, hang on, come back. We're going to talk about
lizards. Not finished
with you. We have lizards to talk about. I was drunk at BoucherCon for the whole time, so.
I like drunk Jay, he's funny.
Especially when he's with drunk Russell.
That night at Harrogate, I've never laughed as hard in my life.
Go on, I want to go there.
I come to, I'm learning to say this differently, Raleigh.
Raleigh, right.
I looked at it for next year, but it's in, you had LA this year and it's in South Carolina next year. Yeah. I thought I'll just wait until it's in LA again, to be honest. I'm a New Orleans Saints fan because now I watch a lot of American football. I don't know why, but so I've always wanted to go to New Orleans, but that's as bad as cultural as when I get on the side of the country of America.
That one. That's next year, isn't it?
No, I don't know. I don't think that's next. I can't remember where it is next year now.
Next year is 2015 is Raleigh. I think 16 is New Orleans.
Oh, I'll go to that one then.
Yeah, well, I think
there you go. I'm sorted.
As part of City of Culture, they're going to pay for a few people who are going to organise certain things to go and see similar events. So I might try and go out to New Orleans to see how a crime festival's run. Just pretend I've never been to one in my life and see if I can get them to go out there. You can come with me. You know, I probably need assistance. Why? To take notes and photographs and all that type of stuff. We'll all go.
That was my first Harrogate this year. I'd never done that before. And I only did that for one day, so I still don't really... doesn't count, but...
Yeah.
It was fun.
What did you think of it, though? Did you experience it as a writer, or did you experience it as, like, hang on a minute, what, you know, like, there's a lot of people here type of thing?
Well, when I felt, like, for the first couple of hours, it seemed a bit... there seemed a lot of people who didn't know each other who weren't talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't be doing with that. Like, let's, like, I'm going to, like, grab you. Let's go and sit down and let's drink. once the drinking started, everything was fine. But
it gets very different in the evening, I think, when the kind of visitors clear out a bit and it is just all trade. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot nicer around about, I think, maybe 6-7 when it starts to get dark and everyone's afternoon drinking's kicked in.
I look at it like it's a work. So, you know, like, if you all worked in an office together, we'd go out like once a month. It'd be like that, but
yeah.
It only happens like 2-3 times a year. I think that there's always going to be like a bit of a lull, and then we'll all start talking and drinking. And I think that just paves the way. The first time I went, I didn't know anyone other than like two people, and it was a very different festival than it was the year after when I went as a published writer. Well, I think that I went when the proof copies were going out of the first one.
I gave yours away, didn't I, that one?
Yeah, that's right. Because they gave away like a few hundred copies, so people would just like mill around my book, and it felt a lot different then. Mm-hmm. Going there is like no one really knew who I was, or like you know, I didn't know anyone there. It was a very different experience than the year after, and since then I love it. You know, it's there's always someone different to talk to, and it's sad in a way because you only get to talk to some people like for like a short period of time. And you have a good laugh, and then you have to move on to someone else as well, because like you all of a sudden you start seeing the same people every year as well. So it's like, you know, it does get better every year. Jake, do the weekend because
this year I'm still trying to talk people into letting me do a panel. I can't imagine me picking any fights on a panel.
They like that though. That's good entertainment.
Well, I mean, it was a bit of a quiet one this year because there was no real big fights this year, was there?
There was none of that type of thing.
I mean, it was. See, I thought I thought it was set up for a big one when the panels were announced, and it was the Amazon one. They had like the Amazon, I think Mark Edwards was on it, and Mel Sheddett and that. But I knew then, and knew they wouldn't be that type of people who would just try and cause controversy for controversy's sake, like some other people did in previous years.
Yeah.
So I knew it wasn't going to be that way. So I was like looking around to see if there was any others, and there wasn't really anything that I could see. I thought the panel that had Tony Parsons on it might have gone a bit worse for him, but he knew what he was doing on that panel.
What's his name pulled out, didn't he? John Niven pulled out last minute because that would have been the dust up. Definitely.
I think that was the only one where I thought that could be interesting. I think there's good. I think that, you know, it's. I think everyone went into the J.K. Rowling event, to be honest. I think everyone was on their best behaviour.
I think it'll be quite cosy this year coming as well, because it's MC Beaton, isn't it? So I think it might be a bit of a gentle affair this time.
Anne Cleaves is the chair. I think the chair has a lot to do with it though as well. I think I think the previous years we had. I think it was Mark Billingham, and then I think it was Val. Was the year before that, and I think they've been in the, I think they've been in publishing for so long is that they, I think they know how to put on you know, good panels, and they can put their input in there. Whereas I think with Steve last year and this year, I think it would be it was a different vibe definitely with Steve's. It was just a lovely vibe. I thought it was really nice. I think everyone was in a good mood the whole weekend. And I think so. I do think the chair has an effect on how those festivals go. I mean, the festivals, every festival I've been to three this year, and every single one of them has been different.
You went to Bloody Scotland, didn't you?
Yeah, I loved it. Oh, God, I love Bloody Scotland.
Where were you, Jay? I thought you were going to be at that one.
Well, I've got this this kind of rock star. It started as a joke, but it's turning into a real thing that I'll go when they invite me because I'm on the doorstep.
Fucking coincidence.
I was talking to Craig, who's involved with it at BoucherCon, and I was having a whole conversation with him, and then halfway through I realised that what I was saying started to sound like I was pitching for a spot at Bloody Scotland, and I felt like the need to go, I'm not pitching, by the way.
I think the main way to pitch this year was, I can play football, okay, you're on. That was it, pretty much, wasn't it?
Craig managed to get people up there who were just shoehorned onto panels, basically, because they play footy. I think that was where he was going. But it was, apart from the footy match, I loved it.
I want to arrange a football match at BoucherCon either next year or the year after, depending how quickly I can get in football shape. like Brits versus Americans kind of fun football match would be good.
Fun? There's nothing fun about playing football.
Well, it wasn't fun when I used to do it, but I think it'd be fun now because I'm old. So, you know, each time you play football once you're in your 30s, it's just like it's like a gift. It's like, look what I can still do.
I think Ian Rankin thought it was fun for about 5 minutes, but not even that long. And then I think he goes, what the hell am I doing here? I'm a millionaire. What am I doing on this pitch? I can rent on any book and just release it and they'll sell thousands. What am I doing here?
I think with festivals as well, that social media has been a massive game changer, hasn't it, for authors as well? Because like you say, when you go to your first festival, you know nobody, do you? And then all of a sudden you get on Twitter and you get on Facebook and you seem to sort of know everybody there, don't you? And it's an awful lot easier, I think. I think that's probably made a big difference in the atmosphere at these places.
I found that with BoucherCon, it was a bit unsettling, I think, because I've actually been more involved in the US scene than I have in the UK, but I think it's because the online crowd that I hung with, you know what I mean, but I was more involved in that over there than I was here. So when I turned up to BoucherCon, it seemed like everyone who walked up to me knew who I was, always giving me hugs, and it was very unsettling because it's like, this is the first time I've ever been to one of these things. But they'll come up and go, oh, give me a hug, brother. It's like, okay.
And that's what's really lovely about it, though. My first one was a bit like that because I'd been, been blogging and stuff. I think it would have been really intimidating to have just walked in there absolutely cold and not knowing anyone, even if like, I'd hate to be someone who's like, your books come out that year and you're on a panel but you've never met anyone and you've got to walk in there already published. But I mean, think even maybe in that situation, everyone's so welcoming.
Yeah.
I think it's just such a lovely community. It's really surprisingly lovely.
I think you're right there, though, that it is down to the community. I don't think it'd be the same with other genre festivals, to be honest. I don't know. But it does feel like in the crime fiction community, there is a sense of like, you know, we're all together type of thing. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I remember the first, you know, because like, I remember going right back to when I started blogging and that type of thing, is that one of the first people I spoke to was Nick, and the friendship that developed just was that easy because it was like, you know, he's such a welcoming type person. That has been the same since with a load of different people, like, you know, and it was like yourself and Jay and all that type of thing. It's like everyone is really welcoming. There's no sense of like, you're an outsider and we'll wait until we decide that you're going to be, you know, in our gang. It's not like that at all, you know. Right. It's like the first time I went to Harrogate, the first person I bumped into was Steve Mosby, who I'd spoke to a few times. And he then introduced me to Val McDavid, and then Greg Hurwitz came along, and I thought, yeah, that's amazing. But then for the next 3 hours after they got up, and you know, like, and so, you know, we'd gone to check in, or we'd gone to do this and this and this, the next 3 hours I was stood there on my own just thinking, oh, what am I doing here? You know, it's like, but by the evening, you know, more people have turned up, and that's everything. And it's like, so I think there is a case of like, some people I think get put off by the fact that like all these people are talking and know each other. But I've noticed that anyone who comes and joins in the conversation are welcome, you know, and then you just speak to them and it's like,
yeah,
fine, and then we'll judge you after what you said after an hour.
Yeah.
Well, we'll welcome you to first.
Yeah. I just find that I have a drive to go, like, if I see, if like when I walk into place, I have a drive to find the people who aren't talking to anyone and go and like make them talk to someone. But sometimes that can make you come across as the drunk weirdo. They feel like I'm going to start telling them I was in the SAS, and you know, here's my story about who really killed JFK and all.
Look, I've carved it into my arm. Yeah. See, but that's good because among crime writers, you can get away with that. Because the worst, people are going to sit and think, "Wow, he's going to make a really good character," so I'll still listen to him.
Do you guys get the sense of a generation of crime writers? Like, do you think that there's a generation of?
I think there must be. I don't feel like, you know, it's very open, and I don't really get the sense. Even though there obviously is a hierarchy in terms of, you know, how successful people are, and that, I don't get the feeling of a hierarchy on a personal level particularly. But I don't know. I think maybe the generation thing's more a creation of the publishers, maybe. You know, and they kind of like to put us all in vague bands. And what do you lot reckon? Because we're all about the same age, I think, aren't we?
I think so.
I'm 10-40 now, so that's...
You haven't.
Oh, no, you're old then.
Yeah, you're not in our generation, Nick, sorry.
Yeah, I'm in the generation above.
I was trying to find a way to judge it where nobody had to give anything away, and it was just going to be some question like, you know, Kurt Cobain's suicide or something, or did you buy Dookie, but...
I remember being at the nightclub the night Kurt Cobain killed himself, and they played Nevermind back-to-back three times through. So yeah, I'm terribly old. I really am terribly old. But I don't know what generation as such, but I think there's definitely kind of a school, I would say. I don't know if I'd call it a generation as such, but there's a collective, isn't there, of writers working together, I think. You know, and that, yeah, I think it's a friendship thing, isn't it, more than anything, I would say.
Yeah, I'd like to think that's what it is.
I think we're I think what makes it a lot easier, as Jay said earlier, is the social media aspect of it. And I think it has, you know, tore down walls that may have been there before, and that, you know, we talk to everyone, you know, you talk to people all the time, you know, and it tears down that barrier that may have existed before. I don't know what Harrogate was like in 2001 or 2002, but I imagine it's very different than it is now. Not just on attendance levels, you know, just because it's grown over the years, but just because I think people talk to each other all the time. It's like, it's just another extension of that now when you meet up with people. So you may have shared a tweet with someone, or Val McDermid may have blurbed your book either. But, you know, it's like, there is a connection there where it's like, you know, you can speak to these people and there's something that already exists. I don't think would have existed without that kind of social media that existed. Like, so, you know,
when you guys were, in terms of generations then, when you guys were each thinking about being published, or, you know, starting to think about joining into the crime fiction, who were the writers who you felt maybe just ahead of you? Who were you looking to think, well, I want to be like that?
I was looking at the really old guys, I think. I think it sounds really insulting now when I say any names. Ian Rankin was like a massive influence on me, and John Harvey. Mm-hmm. So they were quite a lot older, I suppose. I mean, I've read Billingham's books and Martin Waite's books, and they were as well. I think that's probably because of the police procedural thing, though. So they were the ones I was looking at, so I was writing police procedural. Uh-huh. But then just in terms of, you know, the stuff that I loved that I wasn't going to write, like, I mean, it was Chandler and Simenon and stuff. And I'm still really, really nervous about... I've still not actually talked to Ian Rankin because I'm so completely in awe of him. I keep seeing him at things. I'm just like, hello. And I just can't bring myself to do it because I'm just so fucking in awe of him. I just can't talk to him. Does anyone else have that? Was it just me?
He's a nice guy. I mean, I felt like that with Rankin especially. And I still feel that way with Val McDermid.
Yeah.
In the sense of, like, you know, she's just a presence, you know, she's like, you know, like, you know. But Ian Rankin, it turned out it's just a normal bloke. And I was like, oh, I'm a bit disappointed with that. But all I did there was I just saved a penalty from him in that match, and he was like, give me my name all of a sudden.
So anyone listening, that's the literary tip there. Just save a penalty.
Save a penalty for Ian Rankin, and you'll know your name, and you'll follow you on Twitter as well.
No one even says this is hard. Yeah.
The people would call maybe contemporaries, if you like. You know, people like Rankin seem unattainable in terms of the success they're having, but more the people I felt I could kind of aspire towards. I think Ray Banks was a big one for me. What he was writing was something I thought I could kind of do that. I mean, obviously Ray's a brilliant writer, isn't he? You know, and you know, if I could get anywhere close to what Ray's doing, then I'd be very happy. But he's the first kind of guy I was aware of in terms of not being a massive name, but writing the kind of thing that I wanted to write. And, you know, I was kind of thinking if I could get anything like Ray's doing, then I'd be happy. And he's probably younger than me as well, actually, isn't he, I suspect?
Yes.
Yeah. A little bit, I think.
But he's taken himself away from it. I feel like he's missing at the moment. And it's like, feels really weird because it's like he was such a massive part of the community for when I first came along to it. He was like, you know, there all the time, and he just took himself away one day, and no one seems to have, you know, spoken to him since. Obviously, we have, you know, and I saw Al Guthrie at Bloody Scotland, and he was saying, "Oh no, we talk to him all the time. He's fine."
Yeah.
But it just feels like he's just taking himself away from it. And maybe that's what he needed to do for himself, and that's sound what they like. But he was one of the first names that I came across when I came. But to answer Jay's question, for me, I mean, like, it was I read horror all through my teenage years. Didn't read anything between the ages of 16, 17, and then when I was about 23, 24, I picked up a Mark Billingham book and then read every year what he released. So he was a massive influence. But what actually started me writing the kind of books I was writing now was Steve Mosby. But that's more to do with, like, you know, that's a level that I can't attain at the moment. So because of what he does. So what I do is I just go, well, that's the type of fiction I like, but I want to do it in a different way. So I do aspire to more like Mark Billingham and Rankin and that type of thing. But I think it's difficult as a writer, though, to compare yourself or to show, you know, to say, like, this is where, what kind of fiction that I want to write, because I feel like more of spoken to people than that, it's like, it seems like every writer is exactly the same anyways. You have the same doubts, the same things going on. It's like, you know, that you wouldn't expect. Like, I never expected to hear some of the stuff that that I've heard over the last year from certain writers who are incredibly successful, but are shit scared of, like, the next book being the one that gets them found out. And I was like, how can you think that? You know, you're like 15 books into a career, and you're like 20 books into a career, and it's like, I imagine that, you know, I've never heard the American say it, but I imagine he'd probably be the same. It's like, you know, he's like, you know, this could be my last one, you know, because I might get found out. And
getting found out is something that everybody says as well. It's like universal.
I think the same, but what is it that we're going to be found out for? You know,
we actually
suck,
it's weird.
But it's like, hang on a minute, you know, we wouldn't have got a deal, we wouldn't have done this, we wouldn't have, you know, people buying the book and reading and saying us good things about it if we couldn't write in the first place. So it's that feeling of like, well, what is it that we're getting worried that we're going to get found out for? Rather than just writing a really shit book, it's this feeling of like, it's not that, it's the feeling of like, we're going to get found out in some way that we shouldn't be doing this in the first place.
That pressure on yourself, I guess, isn't it, really? That sort of sense that you're going to let yourself down into more than anything. You know, you're not writing what you think you want to write. You can't get out what you want to say.
I think it's because you don't know whether it's a good or bad book as you're writing it. You've got no idea. Until you give it to your editor, you've got no idea whether you've written a good or bad book or not.
Oh, I know I've written a great book until I give it to my editor. And then it sucks.
The day you start, probably the day you're probably too happy about what you've done is the day you should probably stop in here. Really. The day you're kind of fun, saying, I'm brilliant, I've done this, then that's probably the day you should maybe think about, I don't know, taking up golf or something, isn't it, maybe?
But I think we need fear. I think art needs fear. So stand-up comedians, they get the fear because they go out. And I mean, I think, but basically, I think novel writing is the highest form of art because I'm a wanky and pretentious. And I think that right below that is stand-up comedy. And I think comedians go out and they get the fear on stage because they're facing people. And so there's a high wire act there. You can fail. You can fail badly. And that you create off the back of that. And I think for writers like us, I mean, we sat at desks. There's no real fear there. We have to kind of create it for ourselves.
You can't avoid your readers anymore. It's not like it was 10 years ago where if you wanted to never speak to a reader and completely ignore... Well, we could all shut our Twitter accounts. We're not going to do that. But you can't... There's no ignoring the reader anymore. So we are kind of constantly facing the audience as well. You know, it's... I'm sure nobody doesn't look at their Amazon reviews. And if someone thinks you're a cunt, they can just call you one.
Do you think, though, here's a question. Do you think that's why that James Patterson does what he does, the way he does things now with his books, is that he's kind of removed himself from from having to worry about that anymore. It's like, you know, because he will just
sit on the beach while someone else writes it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, is that the way he's, did he just, did the fear, he couldn't deal with the fear of it, do you reckon, or?
I don't know. I actually just think he's a businessman ahead of a writer, which is, I don't mean that as an insult. You know,
he's a bloody good one.
Yeah. Exactly. And he does sound very, very involved with the collaborative books, assuming it's not a lie. He does seem to put quite a bit of work into them. I'm not sure he's, I think at his age with his wealth, I wouldn't imagine there's that much of an element of fear anymore. But,
I like to think that if things took off in a ridiculous manner, and I made the kind of money that like I could only ever dream of, I would still want to write. I would still want to do what I do now. You know, I'd still want to sit there for hours and bang my head against the wall trying to write one sentence, because I get so much pleasure out of the outcome of it. You know,
it's that, have to come to stages when you might have to, like, say if your name became a brand. And you know, and that was an expectation, and you were making, you could make X amount of millions doing that. There'd have to come a point maybe when, like, your art side, your writing, you'd have to get out another way. So you'd maybe, in order to get the fear and to get the challenge, you'd be publishing something under another name, maybe.
Oh, it could be interesting. I mean, J.K. Rowling tried it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was sad that she got found out so soon, because I honestly believe still that she didn't want to be found out. I think that if you were going to release the name eventually, you know, I think that she didn't want to be found out that soon. And I do believe what she was saying about the fact that she just did want to release a book without any fanfare of being J.K. Rowling.
Mm-hmm.
And it is sad in a way that, you know, she couldn't get away with doing that. I don't know if James Patterson could get away with doing it. Surely how big he is. I think someone would, you know, all it took was some solicitor's wife in J.K. Rowling's case, or solicitor's wife's friend or whatever. I think there's just too many people. It's like people who believe that we didn't land on the moon. There's just too many people involved in that conspiracy for it to ever not come out. You know, it's like it just doesn't make any sense.
Have you heard the Eddie Izzard way of disproving that?
Go on.
Because he just does it through logic. He's like, okay, when did we land on the moon? And you go, 19, what was it? It was 67, wasn't it?
69.
What was 67? What am I thinking of? Anyway, 69. And he's like, okay, so was America at war with anyone? And you go, okay, yes, they were at war with Russia. Okay, who was the most advanced astronauts of the age? Russia. Who had the most technology that could have disproved that America had landed on the moon? Russia. Has Russia ever done anything to disprove that America landed on the moon? No. Okay, America landed.
It is sad in a way that, you know, there is this kind of business element to some people. And when I found that out, because I didn't know what that meant when it says James Patterson and then small letters with so and so. I didn't know what that meant until, you know, a couple of years ago. And it did make me go, well, I do find that a bit sad that, like, you know, that's, he's just a brand now. He's not a writer. He's a brand. And then I had one of the first meetings with the publisher, and they were talking about the brand. And I was like, so it's just the same for everyone. Then, you know, it's like they all want to build the brand. You know, they all want to build a brand. I think it comes down to personal opinion on whether or not you want to go that way or if you want to try and stay true to what you've gone in with.
Nick, would you sell out?
Well, I don't want to get a day job again. So, I guess there's a point where I probably would. Yeah. So I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, there has to be a balance out the way you can live with yourself, obviously, don't there? Because, if you are just writing stuff you don't want to write, then it's going to show into it in the story, I think, ultimately. Yeah. And you're going to produce something that has no kind of passion to it, no spark to it, and it won't last, will it? If you're doing that, I don't think. So no, I think I'll be prepared to sell to a point, but I don't think I would want to bend, you know, to the point where you're sort of having to write stuff you don't want to write. That'd be terrible.
Should we tell people now what the point you're willing to sell out is, just so that you're open for offers?
Well, you know, I'm open to offers. Try me. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. I think you can get me through my website.